Good morning, and welcome to the Tuesday edition of the KRFY Morning Show. I'm your morning show host, Julie Calamine, and I am joined by my co-host, Phil Huff.
Good morning, Julie.
Good morning, Phil. How are you?
Good, thanks. How are you doing?
Good.
We have an exciting show coming up today. Why don't you introduce our guests?
I'd be happy to. For those of you tuning in, I need to make you aware that this is a pre-recorded interview with our two guests who are going to be talking with us today about chemical-free weed control. We're getting an early jump on the gardening season. And our first guest is Paul Herndon of Pleasant Meadow Creamery, also known as Guernsey Goodness. Good morning, Paul.
Good morning, Julie. Good morning, Phil.
You're a dairyman, and you live south of town, and you have a dairy south of town in Sagal.
That is correct.
That's right. And our second guest is Diane Green, who is an organic farmer and educator, and Diane is also the owner of Green Tree Naturals, which is north of town. Good morning, Diane.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Oh, so happy to have you here today. So I've already mentioned that today's topic is weed-free, well, we hope to be weed-free, but chemical-free weed control, and we're going to get going on that.
I just want to say what a great pleasure it is to have you both in the studio, but a longtime fan of Diane's. I took your organic gardening classes over a decade ago. I'll just leave it at that for the sake of both of us. And really excited to have one of the last dairymen in Bonner County in the studio with us today.
That's right. They're kind of a scarce commodity these days, and I'm sure we'll talk about why that is. Diane, why don't you tell us a bit about yourself, the work you do, and how you came to be an organic gardener and educator here in Bonner County?
Well, Green Tree Naturals is a small acreage farm northeast of Sandpoint, and we've been certified organic since 1992. We were with the first group of farmers in the county that certified. We market over 70 varieties of vegetables, herbs, flowers, and garlic. I recently officially retired from the Sandpoint Farmers Market after 28 years. But continue to sell wholesale to Winter Ridge Natural Foods and a couple of restaurants, and have expanded our on-farm stand right there at Green Tree Naturals during the harvest season. I teach organic gardening workshops series on the farm, as Phil said, and have been doing that for a couple of decades. And I also contract with the University of Idaho as a farmer mentor and educator for the Cultivating Success program, teaching sustainable agriculture. And we do a fair amount of on-farm research with University of Idaho and Washington State University, and offer academic internships through both universities.
It's quite a bit to have going on.
I love teaching as much as I love farming, so it's a pretty good mix.
And it's amazing, if anyone's not been out to Diane's place, you would think doing all of that would require so much land, but you get so much done really in a very efficient manner with not a huge farm.
You can produce quite a bit on a small acreage. Size isn't really a factor as far as your dedication and devotion to growing and
it's
managing.
It's inspiring.
Yeah. Well, thank you.
Yes, and in a short season, too, and you make the most of it. You use season extenders, et cetera. We'll get to that later. So Diane, a teacher, of course, an educator, a farmer, retired farmer's market person. Paul, you're a dairyman. Tell us about how you came to be here in Bonner County with a dairy farm in Sagal.
Okay, so my wife and I and two kids at the time moved up to Bonner County in 2004, and we lived in Sandpoint, right near Memorial Field. We bought a rural property in Sagal, and it was initially 20 acres, all forested. And we wanted to produce our own milk, so we bought some dairy goats. And goats are an interesting animal. Didn't produce very much milk, really, since they're so small. It supplied the family, but then anytime we had surplus, nobody wanted to buy it. And then we were usually running shortage. So we decided in 2011 to get a cow. And we bought a Guernsey cow, beautiful cow, very good producer, amazing milk. And then we picked up more acreage in 2010, which is what caused us to get the cow. And then we picked up more acreage later on and decided that we had the perfect land for cows for growing the operation. And people started tasting our milk, buying our milk directly from us, and loved it. And the operation grew from there. And now we have two more kids, and all four of our kids, two of whom are adults, are involved in the business. My wife is in the business. I'm in the business. And we're working every day of the year.
Now, has it always been the fluid ends? So many people, I think, get goats with the thought they're going to make that artisan cheese.
For me, it was just mostly about having a good fluid milk. But we did make cheese with it. And then, of course, when we got the Guernsey cow, we definitely made cheese with that. We eventually will be cheese producers, but at the current time, we're not able to fill all of the fluid milk demand mm-hmm. that exists in Boundary, Bonner, and Kootenai counties. So we're working on that right now.
And they both bring on such an end of production. I hope we get into a little bit of that, that it's more than just going out with a milk pail and squeezing the liquid out. There's an awful lot that has to be done on the other end.
There is a lot of work that's done in dairy. I'll just say that. About every member of my family, so there's six total, plus my son is married, so that adds seven, and every person is almost overworked.
And it's such an interesting story, Paul, because it doesn't sound like it was an intentional career, but it's certainly become one, and one you're passionate about.
It's because people really love the product, and not a lot of people are either in a position to do it or willing to do it. And I think to be a dairy person or maybe even just a farmer in general, it has to be a calling.
It seems so. Well, we're a little ways from weed control, but we're going to come back around to it because that is our topic of today. And it's a problem, weed control, everywhere, right? There are, it's a pest control. There's so many issues of agriculture, whether it's animal agriculture or garden food agriculture. We've got weed control, pest control, our soil health, your livestock nutrition, so many challenges. But and to go non-chemical makes it even more challenging, and yet you've both selected this route. Talk to us about that. Why chemical-free? Diane.
Oh, okay. Well, I've been growing and eating organically for most of my adult life. I think nature has provided the perfect example of how things can grow without chemicals and has done so for thousands of years. Organic isn't something new. I don't think it's a matter of spraying toxic chemicals or succumbing to pests or being overrun by weeds if you don't spray an herbicide or apply a pesticide. I've made a conscious choice to observe nature and live simply and sustainably with as little exposure to chemicals as possible. I've made the choice to grow organically for myself, my family, my love of nature, and for the people that buy food from our farm. I can't imagine doing it any other way.
It seems a very natural choice.
It is.
Paul, tell us about your motivations.
So the reason we even got our first dairy goats was because we wanted food that was non-chemically based. We wanted pure food that's good for you, because I happen to think that the basis of human health is what you put into your body. And we've been eating organically since the 1990s, so basically most of my adult life, and never even considered applying chemicals or synthetic anything to the land from the time we started.
Phil, these two weren't very interested in our Sandpoint City water when we brought them cups of water today.
Well, it's a big topic, how
chemicals
do and don't enter our lives. And,
it's expansive.
And we're focusing on the topic today of the organic or organic style gardening that are available to really the means, as Diane touched on, have been with us for many, many, many generations. It strikes me, though, that you've made a conscious choice that's different from what may or may not be considered mainstream, and yet you face the same challenges. And I think for the audience to appreciate what the choice implies, tell us about the weeds that you face. What are the garden variety gardener like myself knows the roadside weeds, the tansies and the oxeye daisies and the hawkweed and the things that infest our lawn and can creep into the garden, but What are the big threats to your agricultural operation that you need to deal with? And then we can look at how you do that.
Well, I can tell you that when we bought our fields, they had previously been farmed. And then at some point hosted a lot of horses. And horses tend to overgraze and take a lot of the good stuff off the land. And then if stuff isn't added back, then we have a lot of introduced weeds in the county that make it into those fields and pretty much take over. And so each of our, we have multiple parcels that are 20 acres, and each one had very specific problem weeds in them, which most people in Bonner County who have any weed awareness at all regarding pasture will know these weeds. Tansy is one of the big ones. That's common tansy. That's the similar to a sunflower plant, yellow flowering heads, very fragrant plant, very tough weed to get rid of, although I've found a very effective method for doing it. And then knapweed is another really common weed in the county growing along the roadways. Phil, you mentioned hawkweed. There were two types of hawkweed out there. And there was a lot of soil, just bare dirt, with like a fungus growing on it or various stuff way down at the ground level. Not a lot of worm activity, etc. So that's what we got. And it was obvious from the start that wasn't going to feed cows. Cows don't prefer to eat knapweed, and they definitely don't prefer to eat tansy. And then when those weeds start up and begin to take over, knapweed especially is an exclusive weed in pasture. It actually produces an herbicide at the root level and kills off any plants within its immediate area. So you end up going from a very diverse biosystem to one that's very monoculture, just this weed.
In a negative way, for sure.
And just to continue exploring the threats, as I understand, of course, the cows, if they are presented with food that they don't prefer to eat, might not be getting the quantity of food, but there's a nutrition aspect, and there's also the potential for some of these plants to use an expression, sour the milk.
They're actually, common tansy is a plant that sours the milk. And occasionally, and I think we're going to get into this later in the interview, when you're going out to control weeds chemically free, you're not always going to get rid of 100% of them, and especially in the type of acreage we're talking about, because in order to graze cows and grow hay for cows, we need more than just 10 acres or 20 acres. You essentially need at least an acre a cow. So if I'm going to run a 30 or 40 cow operation, that's how many acres I need. And when cows happen to find a patch that has tansy in it, we don't have any mono stands of tansy anymore, but we do have a few plants out there. It shows up in the milk.
And flavor or sourness.
And the customer notices it. It's an interesting flavor. It's not one I prefer. And I always notice it when it's in there.
Mm-hmm. Well, we've heard a little bit about the sort of the selection of weeds that Paul is dealing with. Diane, what are your weed challenges?
Well, first, to be clear, a weed is simply defined as a plant growing where it's not wanted and competing with other cultivating plants. So that said, a weed can be something other than what you may typically consider to be a weed. In our gardens, quackgrass is certainly a major challenge because we ended up cultivating our fields that were all had been fallow for 25 years. But when we first bought our farm 32 years ago, it was a field of tansy and knapweed. And we knew that we were going to go into organic production from the beginning, and we were able to manage that tansy and knapweed by planting cover crop. And as Paul was saying, he referred to it as a natural herbicide. The spotted knapweed has a property called allelopathy, which is a chemical in the roots that inhibits the growth of other plants. And rye has the same quality. So we disced our field and planted rye, which comes up faster than the knapweed did in the spring. And basically, it smothered out the knapweed. And we repeated that for numerous years. And that's the big thing with dealing with weeds is organically, it's not a quick fix.
Yeah. So you're not just simply tilling the weeds under because then they'd propagate more, but you're pulling them and doing something with them. And this is where I think it gets really interesting. You're either burning them or you're composting them, or I think you have goats sometimes that will eat some of the weeds to break down the seeds as it's being composted through the goat.
We don't have goats anymore.
Okay. We used to do that.
We did.
Yeah. So what do you do with the field of tansy when you come across it?
Well, we mowed it first and then planted the cover crop, and we did mm-hmm. cover cropping for a number of years, and mm-hmm. now there's minimal presence of tansy or knapweed in our field. We've done the same with mm-hmm. our road right-of-way for managing it, but the big thing is not letting it go to seed, so it's not mm-hmm. going to increase that way. So we do a lot of mowing and weed whacking.
Going to seed is terrible, so you're wanting to prevent seeds, mm-hmm. of course.
Yep.
Yeah, that's a big one. Paul, you look ready to talk tansy. You'd like to talk about your tansy control.
So our two big ones were the same as Diane's. It was knapweed and tansy. As it turns out, knapweed is actually a very easy plant to get rid of. You can take a pure stand of knapweed and get rid of it easily. One way you do that, and we started actually the way Diane did, by disking the field. And so we essentially converted the entire field back to dirt. And then because it was going to be pasture, we replanted with three plants. We do red clover, a very great nitrogen-fixing plant. And then we do two types of grasses, because we know we're irrigating, and otherwise I would do three types of grasses, but one is orchard grass and then one is timothy. And those plants all came back great, but of course the knapweed comes back and the common tansy, and actually tansies can get spread by disking, because one of the ways it spreads is by seed. The other way is by its roots. Mm-hmm. And so if I drag piece of its roots down in an area it didn't exist, now I'm going to have tansy there. So the knapweed we got rid of just by the disking, and then by watering, grazing, controlled grazing, and hand pulling. And, I mean, for years, several years, I would go out with 5-gallon buckets and pull knapweed. Everyone I could find, until I can go out in that field and there is no more. It's literally gone. We're talking 40 acres.
Wow.
And there's no knapweed out there. But it took about 5 years.
That's a lot of, that's diligent.
And you have to get it. Knapweed seeds, it goes to flower in August typically. And you have to be getting it right before that. And then if it's before it flowers, we just drop it on the ground. We'll pull it and drop it. Mm-hmm. If it actually has flowers on it, that's when we stick it in the 5-gallon buckets and we get rid of it completely. We don't leave it out there. And then if it's actually flowered and closed back up again, that's when you really have to be careful, because you're holding a seed bank in your hand. Tansy, the way we got rid of a lot of tansy, although we still have some out there, but we had pure stands going right through the middle of the field. And if you were to look at our the Google map view, which is from 2014 of Pleasant Meadow Creamery, you'll see that we were running chicken tractors, which are 10 by 12, 2-foot high structures that are filled with chickens. And we were running them in circular patterns over what were tansy stands. And we literally cut the tansy population by 90%. And then with all that great fertilizer going into the soil and then the controlled grazing, all the other plants proliferate around it. You end up with a lot more than the four I seeded out there. Mm-hmm. And they all compete really well against the tansy, so that over time, I'm in my 10th year on one of those fields, and I probably cut the tansy 95%, but I still have 5% out there.
Mm-hmm. Diane, do you use animals? Are you using chickens or ducks or any kind of...
We maintain a flock of laying hens, but we don't really use them for weed control other than when we pull weeds. We feed them to the chickens. That's kind of our process.
Sure.
But in talking about weeds, one of the things I wanted to mention was dandelions. And oftentimes in the springtime, people will come out to our farm and they'll see all the dandelions blooming and they're going, oh my gosh, you got to get rid of those dandelions. Well, I'm proud of my dandies, and they are really the first food for the beneficial insects to feed on in the springtime. So we have a lot of dandelions. The key is to not let them go to seed, because, you know, when you blow on a dandelion, you got a lot of seeds going out there. But we do manage a lot of what we grow for the beneficial insects. And a lot of those weeds, like dandelions, are fantastic for the pollinators. Mm-hmm. And not a bad thing to keep.
And there's a good example of a plant, too, that's had its cultural uses for wine or the bitter greens. And throughout a millennium, people have used dandelions.
Absolutely. One of our new weeds has been purslane. It's been coming in thicker and thicker every year. And we weed it and give it to the chickens, and they love it. But in a lot of places, it's considered a delicacy.
Right. So, edible.
So I want to do something for the listening audience. Paul, would you describe in more detail what you mean when you say you're disking a field?
So in our case, we actually, more than just disking, disking typically would mean you're going out there with a disc harrow, which would be a round disc that has to dig into the soil, and it basically turns the soil over slightly, but doesn't typically go very deep. And if you're going into a really well-grassed area, disking, you actually have to make a lot of passes one way or another to really dig down. If it's a heavy weed-infested area, as in, say, knapweed, it'll disk pretty easily. You might only have to go about two times across it. In our case, we were dealing with some areas that were very high knapweed, very low root structure that you could disk easily, but other areas actually had a good native grass stand, so we used what's called a moldboard plow first. Typically up here in North Idaho, when people are going to moldboard plow, they'll do that in the fall. So you'll go out with a cutter and cut everything down to ground level, moldboard plow before the ground freezes. And a moldboard plow takes a pretty deep cut of soil and flips it over upside down. And then you leave it that way all winter, and then you come in the spring and disc, and then you seed. Mm.
So not for your necessarily for your everyday gardener or farmer, but really a useful technique for the larger areas of land. Diane, what about you and tilling? Is it a kind of a spading? Is it the same process? Do you have a disc? Do you disc every year?
No, we use, we have two tillers. We have an 8.5 horse and a 7.5 horse. The big one is called the horse tiller, and the other one is the pony. So we call it our horse and pony show. The pony is mine. The horse is Tom's. Yeah. We've been experimenting with minimal tillage. We have 2.5 acres in production, so we've tried some no-till, and we continue to experiment with that, but we try to till as minimally as possible.
And what is the advantage from a weed control standpoint for minimum tillage?
It will not bring, well, that's been our experiment. Part of the, when we have not tilled, the weed seeds remain deep into the soil. And then when we go to the plant or turn the soil over, the weed seeds come to the surface and they sprout. So we've been experimenting with some different types of cover cropping systems and using cover crops that have that chemical allelopathic tendency, like mustard as a cover crop, and by planting that, cutting it, and leaving it lay, it prohibits or inhibits the resprouting of weeds.
Mm-hmm. And how does that affect the vegetables you're wanting to grow?
You have to wait about 3 weeks after planting and turning it over before you plant a crop into it. But we've had great success with that using seed from Mighty Mustard, which is a Spokane Palouse-grown product.
So we've talked a good bit about weeds, but other threats to your enterprise, too, pests, the critters, the insects. How do you handle those challenges?
The number one pest for cows is flies. And this year, and actually the more cows you have, the more flies you have. Now, they're not out there damaging your plants, but they're just being a nuisance to you and the animals. And we're going with a new method of fly control this year. The old method is make sure you're rotating your composting manure, making sure you're getting it spread on the fields at the right time, etc. But this year we're using fly predators, which are a wasp that then dines on fly larvae. Mm-hmm. It lays its eggs and they consume the fly larvae.
All right. And of course, pests will be another a later topic, so we won't delve deeply. But Diane, what are your biggest pest concerns? Then we'll move back to weed control.
The pests vary year to year. It depends on what type of winter we have. But our primary way of controlling pests is crop rotation, which is huge. If you had a pest in an area by rotating crops, they may have laid their eggs there, but they'll move on. Probably companion planting, and we've done trap cropping. We always do some kind of trap cropping, which is actually planting something that the pests are attracted to. And more than anything, we hand pick. I mean, that's a big part of what we do is by hand.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, we've talked about some of the techniques for controlling our biggest weeds. Do you feel we've talked about our most important weeds that we in the North Idaho area deal with? Are there any we're missing, and are there different methods for dealing with those? Maybe your St. John's worts, or just any ideas from you two. Are there any other really top five weeds that we need to think about?
So for fields, there are three other weeds I can think about. St. John's wort, you mentioned. And then mullein, or mullein, however people want to say it. And then the third one's going to come to me here. The third one is thistles.
Ooh, yeah. Yes.
Okay. And there we have two major kinds of thistles, Canada thistle and then...
Bull thistle. Okay. Maybe. Those are the ones I hate.
They're so the hardest spiky ones. They're yes. Pretty bad. So first for mullein, I actually have a part of our farm, which you don't see when you drive on our farm, that has a lot of mullein. And it actually crops up in a new planting. Like when you go to replant a field, you might end up with a lot of mullein there as if the seed was just laying dormant for a while. What I discovered was in that area, I'm not trying to control the mullein at all. I'm leaving it because I found that the bees really like it. It's the pollinators love it. It's amazing. If you let it go to 6 feet tall, it's amazing if you walk through there how many bees there are. And so I'm thinking, well, this has to be a good thing, right? So I'm just going to leave it alone here. And then the other thing it's doing is it's breaking up with its roots. It's breaking up compacted soil. So you'll typically find it on heavy clay soils. And so mullein, you could obviously go pull it. If you really don't want it there, go pull it or dig it out, etc. Hopefully in its rosette stage before it starts sending up a shoot and casts out a lot of seed. So that's how we deal with it. If we've got it in areas we don't want it, we pull it. If I've got it in an area that I don't really care, I leave it. And then with
St. John's wort. Mm-hmm. It's a tough
St. John's wort actually goes away when you graze. When you do a good job of grazing, it completely disappears. And so we used to have a lot of it on our field, and we have almost zero.
Interesting, because it is a bugbear, isn't it? St. John's wort.
The cattle
places.
Grazing.
I think because if you watch cows when they go out in an early grazing season, first of all, they're cloven hoofed, right? So they're not like horses. They got a split hoof. And they're actually kind of, that hoof is designed to do good stuff to the soil. Mm-hmm. And then if you see the way they eat, like they'll actually pick up knapweed in its young phase as they're just grabbing up other stuff. And whoops, they just ate the knapweed plant. Yeah. So there goes that knapweed plant. And St. John's wort goes with it. And then St. John's wort, once it's been attacked like that, doesn't compete well against the other grasses that were around it. And so we wiped out our St. John's wort super fast. it went away maybe in a year or two, and then it was gone. And we had pure stands of that as well. The thistle is the hardest plant to get rid of.
With grazing animals, they don't want to eat it.
They'll eat it in the early part of the season, but then once it really starts taking off, they won't touch it. They'll eat right around it, right up to it and right around it. So the Canada thistle, that's the harder one. The bull thistle, I'll go out and pull those individual plants throughout the entire season and catch them before they send off that nice cottony seed that seems to fly everywhere that you just see flying through the air. The Canada thistle, we go out as a family and pull every single day. And I set a target for the family, every kid, all right, including myself. Actually, I try to do triple their amount or quadruple. But I spend over an hour a day every day of the summer pulling that plant. And I'll tell my kids, all right, kids, go out and pull 30 today. And if you add that by the number of people in the family and by the number of days in the month, you just got rid of a lot of plants. And it over the years, it makes a difference. Mm-hmm.
So for Paul, it's manual, of course. It's manual animal labor and human labor. And Diane, I'm sure it's something similar. But what are your top issues with must-remove weeds in the vegetable garden, and how do you deal with it?
We spend a portion of every single day during the growing season hand weeding. It's a daily, I consider it a very zen kind of process. I love weeding. I can work out the problems of the world one weed at a time.
And but mainly by hand. You mainly hand weed.
We do. Our routine is to spend a portion of the time weeding every day, but we also mulch. Well, weed plant mulch, and mulching is a huge beneficial way of controlling weeds. But we also solarize the ground. We use weed mat.
I've got a list of methods like that I actually found online. And you just mentioned solarization. You'd better define that for our listeners.
Solarization is basically putting down either a black plastic or a clear plastic. And we always use a 6 mil type plastic that's got UV inhibitors in it, because if you ever put plastic down in your garden, as it starts to break down, it will shatter into a million pieces. So if using a heavy mil, you put that down, and if there's weeds under there, it only works if it's hot and sunny out, but it will sterilize whatever seeds are in there. And a lot of times, just for getting the compost moving faster, and the part of our composting is to kill any weed seeds that have come through. So that's
in addition to blocking the light, it actually helps heat it up.
Right. And if you do clear plastic, it allows the light in, so the weed seeds will germinate. If you do black plastic, the seeds will not germinate but might fry from the heat. Mm-hmm. But weed seeds, one of the reasons they are prolific is because they have the great ability with hard seed coats to mm-hmm. survive the heat and survive that. But we use a fair amount of that for the process. But
so your goal is to get them to sprout under a plastic coating, and then it's just too warm for the young seedlings.
Right, or burn them up. But we also use, like I mentioned before, crop rotation and cover cropping, which is a huge part of managing our weeds. But a lot of it is hand weeding, hand hoeing. I use the weed whacker between the rows. I like putting my MP3 player on under my headgear and listening to music and getting out there and mowing them down.
Yeah, so it's just a daily effort to control them and keep them from going to seed, basically.
Right, keep them from going to seed. But there's a point. I mean, I think people get a little obsessed with having the dandelions in their yard or the weeds around. I mean, like I said, those weeds are good for something.
As long as they're not getting in the way of what you're trying to do with the garden or the cows.
Right.
Yeah. That's right. Well, for those of you just joining us this morning, this is KRFY, listener-supported community radio for the Idaho Panhandle. And Phil Huff and myself are being joined this morning by two experienced weed control folks, gardeners. Our first guest is Diane Green from Green Tree Naturals. She has an organic garden and farm, and she's an educator. And our second guest guest is Paul Herndon, who's a dairyman in South Sandpoint area in Sagal, owner of Pleasant Meadow Creamery with a herd of Guernsey cows that help control his weed problem. Well, let's circle back to the bigger picture for a moment. You know, weeds are everywhere, and you all have adopted really kind of a method or a moral, you just decide ethically it's the right way to go. But weeds are a tremendous problem throughout the world, the country. They're everywhere. They're in recreational areas, wildlife areas. Just looking for an opinion from each of you on your thoughts about whether weed control can ever be completely chemical free. Can it happen? Diane. That's a tough question.
Can it ever be weed free?
Chemical free.
Chemical free, weed free. I mean, I think it can be chemical free, but it's, like I said, I think people are, the noxious weeds are one thing, the garden variety weeds are another. And the thing with the reason chemicals are used is it's a quick fix. It's a one-time application that generally kills everything. And the thing with herbicides for controlling weeds is they're in the same category as pesticides. And both were developed with the purpose of doing a one-time fix. So to do it chemically free, it takes devotion, dedication, and a commitment to making that happen. So backing up, like I said, organic was happening for thousands of years. As time has changed and chemicals have been developed, we push to use those and we go for a quick fix.
And so although they're often used one-time quick fix, they persist for a long time and can present challenges to transition from using applications of pesticides to organic practices. Tell us about how long they persist and how that transition can take time and be a challenge.
Roundup, for example, in working with the National Organic Program and some different programs across the state, Roundup has been found in deep-rooted 5-6 feet down into the soil where the land has not been cultivated for 50 years. If it's been sprayed at some point, it remains, regardless of what there's a reason why there's so many lawsuits against Monsanto / Bayer. Bayer just bought out Monsanto recently, and Monsanto is the one that developed the first herbicides, and they're a pretty toxic thing.
So that it seems that then the challenge for someone who's acquiring some property with the intention to do their farming organically has to look at the legacy of the land they're dealing with, and if there has been a history, then of course they need to know what it is. But it seems like that poses a challenge then for certification for organic purposes or even applying some of the principles in a meaningful way. Tell us about that.
So right now we are just beginning the process of certified organic transition. And when I say transition, that means we actually have a lot of acres, a lot more than if you're doing a home garden. Mm-hmm. We're doing 60 on-farm acres of grazing, and then we're doing 60 off-farm acres of hay production. And those fields, even as recently as last year, that would be some of the fields we're leasing for hay production, got synthetic fertilizer at the very least. Not herbicides, but synthetic fertilizer. And that wouldn't be allowed under the National Organic Standards. And so those fields, their clock started last year in May at that fertilizer application. And those fields cannot be certified organic until 3 years later. So that's the window of time. And then the cows have a year of transition also. And so their year of transition will be the year that all of their feed is in its final year of transition. So to convert to certified organic is a 3-year process.
Okay. And it'll be time. 4 for you with animals. And Diane, you've been organic for a long, long time.
We've been certified 28 years.
Yes. And
congratulations.
I know, and I can tell that you both feel strongly about it, maybe for slightly different reasons. Paul, you're doing it. Talk to us about your decision-making process, and then Diane will hear from you about your commitment to organic.
So for the longest time, from a product standpoint with raw milk, it wasn't necessarily important to also be certified organic. And one of the things you would hope in certified organic, because there is an expense to getting certified and in maintaining certification, you have to have an inspector come, you have to keep all the records, there's a cost to having the inspector travel to you and do the inspection. So you would hope that you're going to make a little more money for the product, but raw milk, by its very nature, already makes a premium, and you're not going to add more premium to it for being certified organic. But what I found is there's a lot of people who produce whatever, whether it's vegetables or animal products, who will claim, well, we're using organic practices, but they're not certified organic, and so they're not actually providing assurance to anybody that every part of their process has been examined and would meet national organic standards. So our reason for converting to certified organic is not a profit reason. In fact, it's going to eat into our profit, but it's to provide assurance to our customers that we are, in fact, doing what we think are the best agricultural practices across every aspect of our operation to every one of our remote fields that we don't even own.
Sure. So people can really have assurance. Diane, tell us about your thinking. It's been many, many years, so you've got a strong commitment to organic gardening.
Well, sure. And I agree with Paul. I mean, we choose to certify organic and have continued to do this for the last 28 years, going on 28 this year. And it's mainly to assure our customers that we're providing them with a chemical-free, non-GMO, herbicide-safe food product. And I think, you know, we're audited every year, and I think that audit means something. And with that audit, that goes along with certified organic meaning something, and I agree with you. I hear that all the time, and not to say that some of those people that, as far as these are gardeners that are selling their product and referring to it as organic, and I think it's really important for the consumer to have the kind of relationship with a grower that if they feel confident and safe with that, that's great. But for us, we can prove it. And I always ask people when they're going through those question marks is, well, prove that you're organic. And they can't do that. So the paperwork that's involved with it is extensive. And the but I think the good record-keeping practices are crucial to managing an organic farm. And this means having a plan and keeping track of how you manage your land. And the organic certification requires an annual application.
Well, that's probably a great note to leave the discussion on for now. There's so much more we could talk about, from the health aspects of raw milk, the production capacities of that, the other principles of organic farming and gardening. We'll have to have you all back on some other time, but thank you for coming in this morning, Paul and Diane. It's been a real pleasure.
Thanks for having us.
Yes.
And yes, thank you.
You're very welcome. We're concluding our talk about weeds in the garden and on the farm. This is KRFY, community-supported radio for the Idaho Panhandle, and we've been listening to Diane Green from Green Tree Naturals, an organic farmer and educator, and Paul Herndon from Pleasant Meadow Creamery, talking about weed practices for his dairy. Thank you very much.